Yes, I left.
Ms. Moss, I want to thank you for coming to speak with us and to thank you for your service to our democracy. What we have just played is a truly horrible and appalling sample, but just a sample of the things that were said about you and your mother following the election. I want to say how very sorry I think we all are for what you've gone through, and tragically, you're not alone. Other election workers around the country have also been the subject of lies and threats. No election workers should be subject to such heinous treatment just for doing their job. With your permission, I would like to give your mother the last word.
Yes.
We're just going to play the tape.
There is nowhere I feel safe. Nowhere. Do you know how it feels to have the President of the United States to target you? The President of the United States is supposed to represent every American, not to target one. But he targeted me, Lady Ruby, a small business owner, a mother, a proud American citizen who stand up to help Fulton County run an election in the middle of the pandemic.
Deposition video of Ruby Freeman, mother of Shay Moss, both former Georgia state election workers, whose testimony was heard Tuesday by the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. Ruby was sitting behind her daughter during Shay's testimony. To see all four public hearings in full, you can go to democracynow.org. We're also live streaming the fifth hearing on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern at democracynow.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Rowland.
Good morning, everybody. This is Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO. You just heard the song Oro by Choc Quib Town, a Colombian hip-hop group from Cali, but their members are from the Department of Chocó. They won a Latin Grammy in 2011 for their song De Donde Vengo Yo. Anyway, that's the opening music, and I played that song to celebrate the victory, kind of astounding victory, of former M19 guerrilla member Gustavo Petro as president, the first leftist president of Colombia, and Afro-Colombian environmental activist Francia Marquez Mina as the country's first black vice president. And to discuss kind of how this came to be, its implications, We've got a guest, Omar Ocampo, who's a researcher for the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. His research interests include wealth inequality, economic democracy, and Colombian-Venezuelan politics. Good morning, Omar.
Hey, good morning, and thank you for having me.
You're quite welcome. We're really glad to have you. And I thank your media person, Olivia, at IPS for once again coming through at the last minute. It's the second time I think with a day or two notice, asked her to provide me a guest on an important topic, and so I really appreciate it. You can thank her for me. That song I just played, I just kind of got that off the internet, and it looked interesting. The video actually seemed to show it maybe having a critical view of gold mining. I didn't understand the lyrics. Do you know anything about that?
So oro means gold in Spanish, and that's actually one of the biggest issues in Colombia. There's a lot of illegal mining, and they're controlled by illegal armed groups, and it's very exploitative. And a lot of times, that results with a lot of violence. So, and it's also a critique of extractivism. The extractivist industry, is not just environmental destruction and climate change, but also human displacement. So that's one of the things that I'm a big fan about the Petro Marquez program. It's its heavy emphasis on protecting, collective land rights and granting autonomy to indigenous and Afro-Colombian communities, and combating, the mining industry and extractivism as part of that struggle.
And am I right in remembering that actually one of the big issues that Marquez had been working on was against gold mining, illegal gold?
Yes, that is correct. There was a big multinational firm that got a contract where she was living, and that basically disrupted the local economies and also the contamination of rivers and plus the environmental destruction. So she was one of the lead activists, and she even led a march in Bogota challenging the then president Juan Manuel Santos to protect this community. So, and she was able to win an award, an international award, because of her activism.
So before we take a deeper dive into this election, talk more about the specifics of who they are, how they won, who they defeated, and maybe take a dive into some Colombian history, which I've just been quickly reading up on Wikipedia, which is incredibly fascinating. Thank goodness for Wikipedia, I got to say. They do a really good service. Anyway, I'd like to hear a little bit about your own story. You do have Colombian roots, right? Maybe just to give us a brief sketch of how you got to be and your family got to be in the United States, where you're from in Colombia.
Yeah, so my family's from Jericó, Antioquia, which is one of the biggest departments in Colombia. Antioquia has a lot of cultural power. So usually in the United States, when people think of Antioquia, of Colombia, they think of Antioquia, because most of the food that's served in North America and most of the migrants who are here, they're from that region. And my family came here in the 70s to the United States, looking for better opportunities, better life. And because of I was born here in the United States, but because my family's from Colombia, I was able to get Colombian citizenship, and it's only natural that I become interested and fascinated by the politics of Colombia and its history. That's pretty much my journey. I travel to Colombia quite often. My dad currently lives in Medellin. I'm able to establish links and speak with the people and see what they think.
And I understand you're actually there, kind of in the lead up to the current election. I know that so you'll have maybe some firsthand accounts of what's been going on there, and maybe some of the excitement. And I'm sure you've heard directly. And the reason I'm talking to you is I listen to the Democracy Now. I've been listening. You know, I heard that it was going into a runoff, and mostly from Democracy Now. There has not a whole lot of attention paid on the major media. Then I just heard the Democracy Now! Show on it yesterday with, some extended interviews with Petro, older interviews with Petro and Marquez, and just really inspiring. I hadn't really tuned into the political vision that they have. And I don't know, I mean, rhetoric is one thing and actions are another, but boy, they both have some really, really powerful words that seem to represent to me, I don't know, a really kind of cutting edge politics, progressive politics that's really responding to all the intersecting crises in our world. It might be a little grandiose, but I don't know, that's the feeling I got. It really gave me a feeling of excitement that I think that I needed in my life, and I think we all need. And talk a little bit about. Let me just read this just so people have a little more if they don't know the. So Petro and Marquez won with over 50% of the vote, not a huge margin, defeating right-wing real estate millionaire Rodolfo Hernandez. According to Democracy Now!, which featured the election on their yesterday's program, the pair will now face a major challenge to pass legislation in the conservative Congress where they lack a majority. Anyway, the hurdle has been overcome by winning the election, but the main hurdle, the establishment, cannot be changed by the government. It has to be changed from the people by the people, said Manuel Rosenthal, Colombian physician, activist, and grassroots organizer, who was a guest on the show yesterday. So they're going to have, there's a lot of dimensions to this. There's the inspiring political vision that they have, the victory that they're able to achieve, what it represents in terms of, grassroots movement building, struggles for democracy over the years. And there's also the fact that they're in maybe a similar situation to the United States in terms of political deadlock in the Senate there. So there's a lot of intersecting. So maybe just start out, what's your kind of analysis of what's what led up to this moment and what it portends?
Yeah, so I think to understand the phenomena of Gustavo Petro, we could probably look, 70 years back in history, when there was a campaign of political extermination between the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party, and I think much of modern Colombian politics history can be traced back to then. But I mean, basically the left has been pretty much systematically excluded. They have tried to organize in the past. People who are activists, they get assassinated or murdered. There was the first ever leftist oppositional party that ever existed was called the Unión Patriótica, which means the Patriotic Union, in the 1980s. They had some initial success at the local and regional level, and then they were just wiped off the map by illegal armed groups who came and basically assassinated 3,000 of their members. So the fact that, Gustavo Petro, who was a former guerrilla, he engaged in the peace process in the 90s, and he, entered politics. He was he's an economist, he became a senator, he became a mayor of Bogota, and now he's the president. I think that is, very inspiring for people who felt like if they engaged in a certain form of politics that they could, they're putting their lives at risk. So it's amazing. It's definitely, and that's why, one of the reasons why it's being celebrated. It's historic that, that he even made it out alive, at the end of these last two campaigns. So now, with regards to the actual politics of it, now that he has won, and he definitely has a challenging road ahead of him. His coalition does not have majority in Congress, and he will have to negotiate and spend a lot of political capital. But You know, I also watched that Democracy Now! Interview, and, you know, I don't think Petro actually has to compromise or ally with the far right. One thing that's interesting about the Colombian politics is that once Congress is in session, each political party has to declare their position with regards to the new administration, so they will publicly choose whether they will support or oppose or be in the position of neutrality. And critical for Petro will be the disposition of the two center-right parties, which is the Union Party and the Liberal Party. And they will determine whether or not his agenda succeeds or fails. And I think there's room for optimism because this morning the Liberal Party announced that they're not going to declare themselves to be in opposition to Petro and Marquez. And they're currently having like an internal party debate about whether or not they will support or be neutral. Now, that means that, you know, if they're neutral, I fully expect them to, you know, support, you know, peace and to combat climate change. And they might, you know, stall or may not support some of the more progressive aspects of their program, like a federal jobs guarantee or, you know, tax increases on the wealthy. So I'm actually a little bit more optimistic than most, but I'm also aware that, you know, the honeymoon period could be very, very short-lived, and there'll be a congressional stalemate, like, very quickly, and his approval ratings, you know, collapse, you know. So, but yeah, that's my reading of the current climate.
And you are Omar Ocampo, and you're with the Institute for Policy Studies, the Program on Inequality and the Common Good. And this is a live talk show with call-ins. I'd like to invite you to get your call-ins sooner than later at 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. As I said, I was really inspired. Just seems like a real breath of fresh air, some of the things that were said. I'll just mention a couple that really stuck out for me, and just really indicates the really interesting trajectory that Gustavo Petro must have undergone from being a guerrilla with the M19, one of three guerrilla movements, one of which, the ELN, is actually still active. And he's actually pledged to begin negotiations or continue or, you know, conclude negotiations with ELN like we're done with the FARC and also the M19, I guess, right, earlier. Anyway, he says, I no longer divide politics into left and right. I think that was a relatively logical way and a relatively realistic way to describe politics in the 20th century. But today politics divided between the politics of life and the politics of death. Climate change worldwide separates into two major sides. On the one hand, you have Trump, Maduro, Duque, and on the other side, you have those of us who want to respond and adapt as quickly as possible to climate change by bringing about changes in Colombian society, economy, and politics. It's life or death. You know, again, it's easy to, you know, rhetoric is easy. But, you know, the fact that, as I was talking to you in our phone conversation private yesterday, that it seems like some of the most interesting voices on the issue of climate change, you know, aren't coming from, you know, industrial Western nations. Well, you know, Greta Thunberg is an inspiring voice, and there are plenty of others coming from the, you know, but a lot of coming from island nations that are threatened by climate change, places, you know, like Colombia, that's a major, I think you said maybe the fourth largest producer of coal in the world. So there's, you know, a lot of interesting voices, people who really get it, even though, you know, his country, Colombia, depends economically on coal, but he's got a real different vision. And that's one thing I'd like you to respond to. And then the other is that he includes Maduro, who's the elected president, very embattled president of neighboring Venezuela. And so I don't know, maybe start on, you know, how he's, some of the rhetoric that he's talking about, like not being left and right. Do you think that's, he's just sort of saying that to appeal to people, or do you think he really does have a real different vision?
Yeah, no, so So it is refreshing to see a leftist movement that challenges extractivism and the fossil fuel industry. You know, 20 years ago when the pink tide in Latin America first started, the pink tide being the election of leftist presidents in Latin America, they gave a lot of lip service to, climate change and they just continued, exploiting, oil and natural gas at record level. So it's good to see someone that, understands that climate change, displaces communities, destroys the environment, contaminates, nature, and it also exasperates or aggravates, inequality. Now, with regards to Venezuela, so Venezuela is a very, critical issue, and it is a topic that has generated a lot of speculation. But one thing that is certain is that Petro will reestablish diplomatic relations with Venezuela. And whether one considers this a good thing or not really depends on the individual's perspective. But considering how many Venezuelans live in Colombia and how many Colombians live in Venezuela, it makes no sense to have no diplomatic relations. So I'm of the position that this is an overall good thing. The two countries can reestablish, trade partners. They share a 1,300-mile border. There needs to be cooperation, to guarantee free movement of people, to tackle the illegal economies that run rampant along the border region. And then Venezuela will be an important, for any peace talks that involve the ELN, because they have expanded and have, camps in Venezuela. Now, so I think, relations with Venezuela is essential. Now, whether Petro says, I don't see things left or right, I definitely think that's rhetoric that is meant to appeal or try to, assuage the hard right, because many of the hard right just see Petro as someone who has an affinity for Maduro and that he will simply try to replicate the political program and economic model that is currently existing in Venezuela, and they're just fear-mongering. Now, I do think that Petro's program is mainly like social democratic, which I would consider kind of like a center left. Marquez has more of like an anti-capitalist disposition, but I'm pretty sure that they're all going to work, within the limits of the system. But I think the rhetoric of life or death is also very, very important, because in the past 20 years, under the hegemony of Uribismo, because from 2002 to 2010, Alvaro Uribe became president. He's a hard right president, and he had, a big, his whole program was based on security and having like an anti-FARC, anti-guerrilla nationalism that promoted basically a warlike disposition, and that resulted in a lot of human rights violations. There was a scandal called the False Positives, and I think it's poorly named because what it really was extrajudicial killings where over 6,000 civilians were killed and they were passed off as guerrillas. Right? These are huge human rights abuses, and that the hard right just turned a blind eye to it or say, they find ways to justify it. So in order, to turn the page to get away from, war and the people who benefit from war, we need to advocate for peace. And I think there's a lot of people, both on the left and some on the right, because the Liberal Party, they're a center-right party, but they supported the peace accords. So, there's a lot of people on the right who want to be able to live in peace and live with dignity and without fear when they go out to the streets.
Again, you're listening to Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, your listener-sponsored, community-oriented, community-supported radio station here in Portland, Oregon. I'm Paul Rowland, and my guest is Omar Ocampo. He's with the Institute for Policy Studies. Again, we're inviting you listeners to call in at 503-231-8187. Okay, so you brought up the pink tide, which I did flag and explained some on my program page at kbo.fm, Wednesday Talk Radio. You can get that. And, you know, I think the Wikipedia entry where I drew all my information from seems pretty decent to me. Mm-hmm. About the pink tide. But I want to hold off on that just a little bit, because you brought up that period, which was in the Columbia Wikipedia page. You know, it beats reading the whole book. You know, it really telescopes things and is very convenient for talk show hosts, I must say. Anyway, so that period you're talking about in the late 40s and early 50s came to be known as La Violenza, I guess, uh-huh. Between the two dominant political parties, as you mentioned, and at least 180,000 people lost their lives in that period. So, I don't know, it just struck me, I could be off base, but somehow the guerrilla movements were started in the early 60s, must have had something to do with that. And let me just add two little things to that. One is that, you know, it must have been obviously exclusion. You know, it was basically, you know, Chiquita bananas were a major presence. So I guess you could call the Colombia a banana republic, like some of the Central American nations. So you had, you know, the same kind of oligarchy and multinational corporations and just massive, you know, basically a feudal type of system, I assume. So anybody trying to go against that had a hard row to hoe. And so I guess it's just almost only natural that if you can't do anything there, you know, there's no space in the political system, it's more likely for guerrilla movements to arise. But then they in turn kind of harden the situation, and as you said, they, you know, murdered some of the people from the first attempt at a electoral a political movement. And so there's no space in the middle there, no space for some sort of institutional type movement. And obviously it was a military stalemate for decades, just a brutal stalemate. There was really seemingly no hope, especially after after the Soviet Union fell, no hope of like actually winning a revolutionary struggle in that country, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, place like Nicaragua. Anyway, I know that's a big piece to chew on, but talk about how that period in the 40s and 50s sort of led to the guerrilla movement. Just give us a little more, flesh that out a little more.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would even bring it back to 1910, when there was more of like a democratic opening, and the conservative party Russians were able to get power, and they had hegemony for like the next 20 years. So even though there were elections at that time, it was very, I would argue, unfree and unfair. And it was also very exclusionary in the sense that, yeah, so the conservative party, you know, are in power, but then they had like a zero-sum game where very little position or input was from, there was very little space given to the Liberal Party. But then in 1930, the Liberal Party came into power, and they basically replicated the same thing that the conservatives did, you know, for the 20 years prior, which is they won competitive elections, but then they basically shut out the conservative party, you know, for the next 16 years. And then there was a new political figure named Jorge Gaitán. He was actually a socialist, and, you know, he was talking, he had like, you know, some pretty good rhetoric about democratizing and bringing the masses into the political process. And he was, even though he was a socialist, he was part of the Liberal Party. But then he was assassinated. Once he was assassinated, this generated, La Violencia, which means the violence, which was basically a 10-year civil war fought on very partisan lines. And, you know, this is something that, you know, even my dad would explain to me. Let's say, you know, he's from Perico, so that village was a conservative village. If someone from the Liberal Party was somehow, you know, in that village, it was a very high likelihood that they would force him out, him or her out, or kill him or her, you know? So it was, the partisan violence was very real. Now, the founder of the FARC was actually a member of the Liberal Party at that time. And, you know, he started to organize some self-defense groups in order to, you know, basically combat the death squads from the Conservative Party who went and targeted the Liberals. And when, you know, those self-defense groups, you know, became joined by the Communist Party of Colombia, other socialists, other groupings, and then collectively, eventually by the 1960s, they became the FARC. So, so the FARC,
which was maybe the leading of the three eventual insurrectionary groups, the FARC was the biggest.
It eventually became the biggest, but in the 1980s, the one that attracted the most attention was actually the M19,
which the new president was originally a member of. Yeah,
that is correct. Once the M19 demobilized, FARC definitely became the leading guerrilla group, and they had the most support in the rural areas. They had some support in the urban areas, but they definitely with the peasantry that had big support, and they tried to help organize the laborers and at a area or region that cultivated bananas or plantains, and they actually gained a lot of power by the 90s, controlling big parts of the country. But the point is that the genesis of the FARC is related to the civil war that erupted in the 40s and 50s, and how exclusionary the political system was, because whether it's a conservative or liberal who was in power, there was very little space to operate for those who have a different political vision or ideas.
Mm-hmm. So Gustavo Petro, the new president, he went through that demobilization of the M19. That must have been a formative experience as well, yeah?
Absolutely. And I think, it just shows that, when you have more inclusive politics, there's less reason, to take up arms. I mean, the M19 started in the 70s because of electoral fraud in the 1970 presidential election. And again, it just shows a pattern of exclusionary politics, where it just wouldn't let other people participate. Now, of course, these guerrilla groups didn't behave ethically, 100% of the time. Some of them were very violent, committed terrorist acts. Like, I don't want to, excuse that or justify it. But, but in the 1990s, the M19, engaged in a peace process. They demobilized and they became a legal political party. And they were actually one of the main protagonists in the drafting of the 1991 Constitution. So they had like a constituent assembly. I don't remember the numbers exactly, but I want to say like almost half of the constituent assembly were M19, former M19 guerrillas. And so, they drafted a very good and solid constitution. The only problem is that a lot of the provisions are not enforced. Because of the level of violence that exists, political violence that exists in the country. Mm-hmm. So Petro was able to, participate in the political process and gain some success. He became mm-hmm. a senator. He became someone who led an anti-corruption campaign. He exposed the links between paramilitary groups, illegal armed groups, and their links with some mainstream politicians. It was a scandal called Para Politica. So basically, that sent like 60 senators to prison, or congressmen to prison. Then he became mayor of Bogota, and similar to what his current platform is, with green energy, he lowered carbon emissions in the city of Bogota, and he was able to win some international awards for his his green initiatives and having, you know, energy efficient, you know, taxis in the city. So, so I think, you know, for anybody, you know, and then also it's no surprise that once he has won, the ELN has already said that they're willing to engage in peace talks. And it just shows that if there's a political space for, you know, people to participate, and for it to be truly democratic, you know, there's no reason to take up arms.
Thank you for all that. I want to, I actually kind of wanted to go even further back. You mentioned 1910. I wanted to go back to 1810, but I know we've got our first caller, Harry, been waiting for quite a few minutes, and you can also call in after Harry at 503, or you can call in now, 503-231-8187. We've got less than half an hour left. Go ahead, Harry, what you got on your mind today?
Oh, thank you for taking my call. And I need your opinion on a few questions. The first one is, with Petro winning the presidential election, one of the reasons why was how bad the economy is in Colombia. In fact, I remember all the demonstrations last year about when they tried to raise the sales tax to 29%. And how is the economy in the Colombia today?
Harry, thank you for that question. So you're absolutely correct. I don't think, I would argue there are two reasons why Petro's president today. One, I would argue, would be Francia Márquez herself. So his running mate, she has, you know, direct links with grassroots movements, and she was able to mobilize a lot of voters who normally wouldn't go out to vote. And, you know, and that included the indigenous community and the Afro-Colombian community. They came out in big numbers in support. So I think Petro owes a lot to Francia Márquez. Now, the second thing, more directly, absolutely, I don't think Petro wins without the fiasco that is Iván Duque. He had very poor 4 years. From 2018 to 2019, poverty increased. So there was bad performing economy. Then he tried to implement this, you know, increased taxes basically on the poor and middle classes, which generated, you know, a protest movement and a general strike, one of the biggest general strikes in like in a generation in the country. And then there's just the poor management of the pandemic. You know, right now, 40% of the country is in poverty. Colombia is one of the most unequal countries in the world. You know, and even though there's some positive, you know, the economy is starting to bounce back and it's starting to, you know, become normal as it was, well, normal in quotes in the pre-pandemic, it's still not good enough. It still doesn't open up a lot of economic opportunities. Social mobility is really poor in Colombia. There was a OECD study in 2018 that said that it would take a low-income family 11 generations in order to reach the middle class. That is a mind-boggling statistic, in my opinion. So yes. So, without, you know, the poor performance of Iván Duque and the number of discontent that he generated amongst the, you know, the populace, it definitely paved the way for Gustavo Petro to win.
Okay, Harry, we'll give you one more question because we got another caller and other people waiting. Go ahead.
Okay, next one is, there was not a de facto war, but there was a tax from Colombia into Venezuela. They blew up a power plant. They were doing things like that, and hopefully this will stop with this new president. And I didn't know FARC was in Venezuela itself, so were they attacking each other, or were they and hopefully this will stop, and now that they said that it will start diplomatic relations again.
Okay, thanks, Harry.
Thank you, Harry. Yeah, so the Colombia under Iván Duque has definitely had a warlike disposition towards Venezuela. So Duque just basically followed whatever Donald Trump wanted. So Donald Trump, you know, threatened, you know, military solution, basically like regime change, and Duque, you know, followed that to a T. And under Duque, the diplomatic relations were completely cut off. Now, I think with Petro, we're definitely going to have, you know, more of a collaborative and diplomatic approach. And I think that's going to generate a lot of controversy in Colombia itself, and maybe even within the United States. You know, it really depends on how Joe Biden views it. But it's going to generate controversy inside Colombia, because people are going to start fear mongering about the direction of the country. So, but any type of, you know, covert operations, I'm pretty sure that's going to cease, and you know, there's going to be, you know, negotiations for normalization and peace with the ELN, which is currently has some basis in Venezuela at the moment.
Before we go to Tawasi, our next caller, I just wanted to, it will be interesting to see how Biden responds, especially considering since he excluded Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua from his recent summit of the Americas held, and had talks with Bolsonaro. Interesting enough, didn't exclude Bolsonaro. So I don't know if you want to respond to that or go to our next caller.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that there is an opening for collaboration between the U.S. and Colombia. I mean, U.S.-Colombia has always been, you know, very, very good partners. So a lot of people are speculating that there might be some disruption on this. And the two areas of contention will be drug policy and approach to Venezuela. I'm curious to see how things go, but there's a lot of areas where they can also collaborate, and that is climate change, you know, and protecting the environment. This is, you know, something that, you know, Biden also believes in, and maybe there could be some type of exchange where there's some heavy investment and collaboration on clean energy, which is needed to, you know, create new jobs, you know, move the country away from fossil fuel dependence, et cetera.
Yeah, if we can stop this war in Ukraine that is, has unfortunately led to a complete throwing out the window of a lot of the green initiatives that were at least tentatively being started. But anyway, we can hold off on all that. Let's go to our next guest, Tawasi. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate you guys talking about this important subject and everything KBOO does. But my question is about indigenous people in Colombia, because, you know, here in Portland, indigenous people face a lot of repression, state repression. And I was just reading about Jesus Antonio Montaño, and I just was hoping you could talk a little bit about the indigenous people of Colombia and what their demands are and why they're facing assassination. And further, who benefits from assassinating indigenous people in Colombia? And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Tawasi.
Many thanks for your questions. Very important questions. I will say that the indigenous community in Colombia overwhelmingly supported Gustavo Petro and Francia Márquez this election. And they do, unfortunately, face a lot of violence at the hand of, you know, some shadowy forces. One of the reasons why they are targeted is because, you know, people want to displace them from their land in order to, you know, exploit the land for, you know, natural resources or for, trying to expand the cultivation of coca leaves, which is basically to expand the drug trade. And this is one of the reasons why they're targeted and intimidated. And then there's also just, like, you know, a racist history that exists in Colombia where, you know, their identity is mocked, or their identity is trying to uproot their identity, basically, you know, telling them to assimilate to the, you know, the wider culture, to you know, not speak their native languages. And part of the program that, you know, Gustavo Petro and Francia Marquez are advancing is, you know, the protection of, you know, collective rights and the preservation and protection of their native languages, and also to, you know, territorial rights as well. So, yeah, so and again, the indigenous community was also strongly against against Duque. They've even had their own protests and, you know, shutting down roads, et cetera, in order to, you know, for the Colombian state to basically, you know, look at their demands and meet them. And, you know, and that includes some, you know, levels of autonomy. So, yeah, that's the, you know, the situation with the indigenous community in Colombia.
And I will give out the phone number one more time, as we only have 15 minutes left. So you better get your calls in the next 5 minutes. If you do want to call in and talk with my guest, Omar Ocampo, himself of Colombian heritage. His family came here from Colombia, and he now works at the Institute for Policy Studies in their program on inequality and the common good. And many thanks to our friends at Institute for Policy Studies, who've been doing such excellent work over the decades. The progressive think tank courageously trying to combat the massive influence of the right-wing think tanks that grew up post-1960s as a reaction to our own insurrectionary movements in the 1960s. And I don't know, it'd be interesting to talk to you a little bit about some of the parallels. There's a lot of things I've wanted to get into, and there's only a little bit of time left. But again, 503-231-8187, that's the number. That's the last time I'll give it. Call soon or don't call at all, please. We're talking about the recent election in Colombia, which elected, amazingly, a former M19 guerrilla member, Gustavo Petro, as the first leftist president of Colombia, and Afro-Colombian environmental activist Francia Marquez Mina, who's the first black vice president. And what that portends, and the excitement that brings, at least to major sectors of Colombia. Obviously, there's important you know, multinational capital sectors, and some of the same feudal landowner type interests, big extractivist interests that are obviously not so happy with that election. It will be interesting. I don't know. There's been, it's interesting. Australia just elected a Labour president, overtly on a climate change fighting climate change platform. The French elections went to some extent for the leftist parties. Interestingly, I don't, one doesn't want to make necessarily too much of these trends because they often reverse themselves rather rapidly. But then you brought up this idea of the pink tide. And let me just read. It's really quite extraordinary. So the Petro Marquez victory follows on the November 2021 Honduran election of leftist president Xiomara Castro. And just weeks later, left-winger Gabriel Boric won the 2021 Chilean election. And they're part of what some call a second pink tide, although it's more like a continuation of the first, I guess, which also includes Alberto Fernandez in Argentina, Luis Arca following on Evo Morales in Bolivia, Mexico's Manuel López Obrador, Laurentino Cortizo in Panama, and Peru's Pedro Castillo. The first, or beginning, depending on your perspective, of the pink tide was kicked off by the election of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela in 1998, followed by a wave of conservative reaction. So yeah, I mean, one doesn't want to get our hopes up, but I mean, my reaction is always, yeah, because the United States has exerted such massive influence in Latin America, including overtly and covertly supporting many of the most brutal dictatorial regimes, just a heinous record. And so no wonder that a lot of people go against both the United States and their own oligarchies. So I don't know. What do you see? Is this something that's going to continue? Are there? Do you see those sort of some unification happening? Some sort of synergy going on? Some sort of like alternative, really serious alternative political bloc emerging? I don't know. Those are maybe two big questions to put to you. You're just a
yeah. No, that's actually interesting. So one thing that differentiates between the second current wave, pink tide wave, and the first wave, is that Colombia is the one. Because in the first wave, you know, Colombia, you know, did not elect any type of progressive or leftist president. So Colombia is always seen as like this conservative, right wing bulwark, and now it has officially turned. So that's a major difference. I think I would hope that this second wave will learn from the mistakes of the first one. The thing is that in the first one, and I'm speaking generally. I mean, obviously, each country, you know, when you dig in, there's some differences, but in general, once the left got into power, they pretty much ignored the social movements and the base that helped propel them. Could be seen in, for example, like Brazil, where a lot of the, you know, people became upset that he kind of, you know, became like a, you know.
That's Lula.
Hard left. Yeah, Lula. He went from, you know, hard left to centrist. They weren't trying to implement any radical reforms. I do think that there are, and then there was also the cases of like, you know, corruption, et cetera, et cetera. So I would hope that, you know, this new wave is like, you know, make sure to listen to the bases and not get involved in the toxic politics where everyone ends up in corrupt dealings and politics. I think that there is a very big chance, especially if Lula wins in Brazil, and I think the election is in October, that there will be a lot of collaboration, because many of the countries, the continent's biggest economies, will be under leftist presidents. So you have Brazil, Chile, Argentina, Colombia, you know, all under left wingers. I think that, you know, that could spur some collaboration, and with the hopes of, you know, basically everyone having a chance to, you know, build up a regional bloc where they can trade with each other, not have barriers, for the sake of all people, and not just, you know, the multinational corporations or their own, transnational corporations. So I think, plus these administrations all just started, probably with the exception of Bolivia, even though they had like a 1-year interruption due to the coup. The left is firmly back in power in Bolivia. So we'll see. You know, the critical issue will be Venezuela. You know, it's like, you know, how to deal with the discontent that exists there, and then try to get them, you know, back on their feet economically. So,
and also
it'll be interesting.
Well, also, you know, the idea of capitalist encirclement, I'm sure you're familiar with that phrase. It's not really discussed much. But, you know, when you have just one country that's like, say, Venezuela was sort of on its own, certainly on its own for a while. And it leads to, you know, then you get all the capitalist countries circling up to, you know, whether it's a blockade of Cuba, for example. There's certainly the sanctions against Venezuela. It really starts to skew those countries and makes their ability to keep whatever good programs they had going. And also, you know, it tends to sort of this insularity and kind of a sort of maybe a paranoid sort of power dynamic going on. I don't know. I'm not from there, but So maybe the fact that there are other countries, especially neighboring countries, might allow some sort of alternative pressure instead of the antagonistic, aggressive, violent pressure put on them from, say, the United States and others, maybe a sort of a fraternal pressure to allow them to, you know, maybe get back on the right track or something. Anyway, that's just a thought.
No, I agree with you 1,000%, because Duque, Colombia under Duque was pretty much engaging in the rhetoric of regime change and didn't even recognize the legitimacy, and said that they had an interim president, and Bolsonaro in Brazil, you know, he also had like a very confrontational disposition. Under those circumstances, there's no incentive to negotiate in any good faith, right? So I do think that now that you have administrations that are less hostile to you, there could be, like you said, alternative forms of pressure of having some types of reforms in order to get back on your feet. But that also requires the elimination of sanctions on Venezuela, so they can begin to purchase and attract the investment that is needed to rebuild their economy. So
everybody write to President Biden and tell him to end the sanctions on Venezuela, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
And renounce the Monroe Doctrine. I'll just throw in that out there.
Yes.
So we only have a couple minutes left. Let me just throw this out that I mentioned 1810. So there's a long resistance to Spanish colonial rule, for centuries. Led up to finally to the movement that led to the Colombian Declaration of Independence in 1810, which I didn't know actually followed closely on the independence of Saint Dominique, which is now Haiti, which was such a massive historical event that led to just massive repression of Haiti, that led to their sort of disgraceful treatment globally by the United States and France. And Saint Dominique, now Haiti, provided support to an eventual leader of that rebellion, which led to Colombian independence from Spain. And that leader was Simon Bolivar. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Just a little sidelight on history. You can respond to that, or you can briefly talk about the death of Plan Colombia, hopefully.
Yeah, I would also like to highlight that Haiti did more to end slavery than any other country on earth. And they supported, revolutionary movements and independence movements in Latin America in the 19th century, which, like you said, it included Simón Bolívar. It's interesting because when Simón Bolívar was, launching his campaign for independence, he actually faced some revolt from the African population and the indigenous population, because they just saw it as we're trading one form of slavery for another. And since they revolted, it changed Simón Bolívar's mind about the project that he was embarking on, and then he made a commitment that once the revolution is successful, he will end slavery. And that was also one of the conditions that Haiti put on Simón Bolívar for them to give him some material support. So
fascinating.
Yeah. So, and with regards to Plan Colombia, it's it's a very controversial, polarizing issue. Some people view it as a success. Other people viewed it as a failure and a huge, waste of resources, and that didn't combat the drug trade effectively, and the resources were just used to wage war, which, like I mentioned earlier, resulted in a number of human rights abuses and violations and the killings of innocent people. So again, I think it's too early to tell, to see how Petro and Biden will interact and how they will engage, but I'm hoping that the next time some form of aid package is going to be offered, it will be to develop the green the alternative energy in Colombia, and also to, you know, basically alleviate poverty.
Uh-huh. And the whole issue of the status of coca will be very interesting. Wasn't it Evo Morales who legalized the traditional use of coca or something?
Because it's it's part of the tradition in Bolivia. From my understanding, Petro is against, you know, the use of I can never pronounce this word, glyphosate. You know, the air fumigation of, you know, plants and the coca leaves and the force to eradicate it forcefully. He's against that. He wants to, give alternatives to that.
Yeah, great. Well, we got to run. Sorry, we're flush out of time. Thank you so much, Omar Ocampo. Really wonderful talking to you. It's been great. Thanks.
It was wonderful talking to you, and hope to be back.
Okay. Bye bye.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.